My reflection today I've titled, A Qualified Thankfulness. I spent many hours at the Steinbach MB Church in Steinbach, Manitoba, one of the Mennonite meccas in North America. Spent time upstairs in the old education wing with its 70s-style wood-paneled walls, and green carpet. Sitting on those thin but hard wooden chairs with the metal legs that are stackable. One time in particular stands out. I'm guessing I was about 10 years old, and Mr. Regeer had come to visit our Sunday school group. And I'm wondering if we can, do we have that photo we can put up there? There he is. Mr. Regeer was old, at least as from a 10-year-old perspective. His wispy white hair rested delicately on his almost bald head as he looked at us through his horn-rimmed glasses. His voice was scratchy, but a bit hoarse, as he told us his story. Mr. Regeer was born in Russia when he was a teenager, 13, 18, I forget those details. The Communist Revolution plunged the country into chaos. Mr. Regeer's village was caught in the tug of war between the White and Red armies, with control switching from one side to the next on an almost daily basis. As far as Mr. Regeer and his community were concerned, it didn't really matter. White or red, the soldiers took what they wanted, ate what they wanted, slept where they wanted, civilians be damned. That said, there was an advantage to having a soldier, red or white, eating you out of house and home. At least then you didn't have to worry about the bandits, who did terrifying and gruesome things to people. Mr. Regeer said that his parents and siblings were woken up in the middle of the night by pounding fists on the door. The bandits made everyone line up in the middle of the living room and kneel down. Mr. Regeer was at the end of the row and watched in horror as one of the men took his sword and brought the blade down on his father's head, then his mother's, then his sister's. Mr. Regeer said that a voice in his head told him to jump out the nearby window. For some reason, Mr. Regeer obeyed. The bandits couldn't find him as he lay quietly panting in the tall moonlit grass of the hayfield. Somehow Mr. Regeer managed to stay alive. Somehow he got out of Russia. And somehow he ended up in Canada, in Steinbach, with a collection of well-dressed and well-behaved children in that safe and warm room that, for all intents and purposes, was on a different planet a million miles and 1,000 years away from that dark and bloody nightmare he had just described. And somehow, Mr. Regeer was grateful. He was thankful that he could meet us all and tell us his story and not worrying about being arrested or worse. He was thankful that he wasn't starving, that he could go to the fridge any time of day or night and pour himself some milk and eat one of his wife's tasty cookies. He was thankful that he was surrounded by his children and grandchildren, and there were lots of those. Mr. Regeer was like the writer of Psalm 126. When the Lord brought back the captives to Zion, we were like those who dream. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad." Mr. Regeer wanted us to know that God had done great things for him, and he was grateful and joyful. And Mr. Regeer wanted us to be grateful and joyful too. Mr. Regeer wanted us to see that what was a dream for many was our reality. We had plenty to eat to our heart's content, and so much more. Like the psalmist, Mr. Regeer wanted us to be full of glad praises to the God who had done great things for us. I admired Mr. Regeer. Although he was slightly built, Mr. Regeer was a noble giant in my eyes. There was a modest dignity to him. I figured he was a person worth imitating. After all, he was so tranquil, so at peace with himself, given all that he had survived. Maybe it's my personality, maybe it's my upbringing, but when Mr. Regeer or, say, my grandparents reminisced, I felt guilty. Mr. Regeer would probably turn in his grave if he heard me say this, because this would have never been his intention. I felt guilty in that I didn't feel as deeply grateful and profoundly thankful as Mr. Regeer or my grandparents apparently felt. How could I? I hadn't experienced the same losses, the same pain, and the same redemption. I felt guilty for that too. I was only a kid. I thought I was supposed to have a moment to somehow allow the weight of what Mr. Regeer was saying to leave its mark on me in a life-changing sort of way. So I would try to muster up some kind of emotion. I would feel really thankful. And then I would feel guilty when that just didn't seem to happen. I would also feel guilty that I wanted the finer things in life. My dirt bike was nice, but I wanted a 10-speed. And I was supposed to be satisfied with what I had, wasn't I? Although I find it interesting that Jesus appears to have savored the finer things in life. He took time to enjoy the birds of the air and the lilies of the field. He liked a nice bottle of wine, barrels of it apparently. He also had good taste when it came to clothing. Jesus was a sharply dressed man. When he was crucified, his coat was so nice that the soldiers decided to throw dice for it rather than tear it up. I have a confession. I still don't do thankfulness very well. Sometimes I feel bad or guilty about that. Usually I don't. Maybe it's because I've matured, but I suspect it's probably because I've just gotten better at ignoring those feelings. Perhaps it's because of my training. As a student and a teacher, I'm always looking to see how things can be improved. Maybe it's because of the culture in which we live. Commercials tell us that what we have is never good enough, and politicians and business owners tell us that things will only change if we complain loud enough. Whatever the case may be, I've often read the second half of Psalm 126 with a tone of exasperation. The poet writes, "Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. He who goes out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with him." If I wanted to give Eugene Peterson a run for his money, the Jay Janssen paraphrase would probably go something like this. "You've said you'll restore our fortunes. You said that those who weep will be happy and blessed. So, let's get to it." The word of the Lord. Turns out that's a misreading of Psalm 126. The second part of the poem shouldn't be read as a complaint or a demand. Look closely, and you'll notice that the central line of the poem, the high point in verse 3, reads like this: "The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad." Which means that the following verses should be read in a happy, peacefully confident tone. The psalmist is glad, even though the Lord has not yet restored Israel's fortunes. The singers are glad, even though the tears are not yet over, even though the harvest is not yet ready. Is that for real? Is that kind of assurance, that kind of expectant gratitude possible? If Mr. Regeer is any indication, the answer is yes. So why does that kind of uncomplicated posture seem so foreign to me? I mean, I have this habit of qualifying my thankfulness. Yes, I'm thankful for my house, but there are gas bills to pay and gutters to clean and closets to organize. I'm definitely thankful that I never go hungry, but there are dishes to wash, and who knows what chemicals were used on those vegetables, and I've been gaining some weight. Of course I'm thankful for my kids, but there are diapers to change and sleepless nights, especially now that my 17-year-old daughter is showing interest in boys. And there are increased car insurance payments as teenagers get their L and N licenses. I'm thankful for my job, but there are endless meetings, and now I have to shoulder all these new extra responsibilities, and I'd rather be playing outside with my kids than sitting in an office writing a sermon. I'm a ray of sunshine, aren't I? Can you go to that next picture for me, please? There we go. Having said all that, even though I don't do thankfulness very well, I think I'm getting at least a little bit better at it because of a number of things. First, Eugene Peterson has pointed out that feelings are important for many things. He writes, "They keep us aware of much that is true and real, but they tell us next to nothing about God or our relation to God. Our security comes from who God is, not from how we feel. Following Jesus is a decision to live by what we know about God, not by what we feel about God, or ourselves, or our neighbors." With that in mind, I simply have quit worrying about trying to muster up intense feelings of thankfulness in each and every circumstance. That's not to say I don't have moments where I experience a deep and abiding sense of gratitude. I just don't expect that to be the case all the time. In fact, thankfulness is, by definition, just being aware of having benefited from a kind act and then expressing gratitude. So I've simply come to a point where I acknowledge the good things in my life and thank God with whatever emotion there may or may not be in that day. In other words, the important thing is that I've raised my arms in thanks to God. My friend Dave is also partly responsible for helping me be more grateful. When I was working in radio a few years ago, well, now almost a few decades ago, I edited an interview with David Esau, a pastor at one of our MB churches in Coquitlam. One Thanksgiving, Dave and his wife Elaine were expecting their third child. Elaine was 8 months pregnant. She was experiencing pain and it was getting worse, so Dave took Elaine to the hospital. When the nurse checked, Dave said, you could see from the expression on her face something was not right. As things went along, Elaine had to have an emergency C-section. The doctors just started racing. The last thing Dave heard as the door to the operating room closed was, we can no longer find the baby's heartbeat. Let's worry about saving Mom. Elaine almost died from loss of blood. Doctors figured a few more minutes and that would have been it. Dave and Elaine later found out that doctors had cut her open to find the baby right there in the abdominal cavity. There had been a complete rupture of the uterus. The placenta was torn away. Ryan had been without oxygen for a long time. The life of Dave and Elaine's son hung in the balance between this world and the next. For 40 days, Ryan was in intensive care, struggling to stay alive, beyond even the best help that science had to offer. Today, doctors can't find anything wrong with Ryan. He is, as the doctors put it, a highly unusual case. I've come to realize that's another name for miracle, Dave chuckled. That means it doesn't fit into any of our medical categories. When you go to Children's Hospital with Ryan, Dave said, you meet a lot of other families that are going through hard times that will either make you bitter or will make you better. There is an incredible strain on your marriage, and you find that the breakup rate is tremendously high. Elaine and I had to grow, Dave continued. We had to cry together, pray together, cry out to God together, share our doubts and faith together. We wrestled with God together as a couple. We look back on those experiences and say, thank you, Lord, for difficulties because you've made us stronger. You've helped us to achieve a new level of intimacy that we never dreamed of. When we first got married, we loved each other then. We really do now. Dave and Elaine aren't the only ones who claim to have discovered good things in the midst of and as a result of hard times. Of course, saying this can sound kind of trite, somewhat callous, maybe a bit too offhandish or simplistic. I suspect that a large part of that has to do with the fact that Christians are guilty of declaring that good will be the eventual result way, way too early, when the pain is too raw and the disappointment too fresh. I also suspect that it's jarring to talk about being thankful for suffering because Christians often give the impression that we ought to be thankful for everything. Part of this is tied to the inaccurate view that God is directly responsible for each and every single act, good or bad, that has visited upon us. The Bible provides plenty of evidence that evil powers and sinful people, including you and me, carry a fair share of the blame for the grief and pain our world experiences. But that's a much longer discussion for a different day. For now, I think we need to be honest and say that sometimes there might only be a tiny bit of goodness that comes out of a bad situation. In fact, there are plenty of biblical stories to suggest that sometimes there's only a small glimmer of goodness in a situation, and you have to look pretty hard to find it. Those who go out to sow in tears, the psalmist writes, but they at least go out bearing seed. Keep our eyes peeled, and we invariably find something to be thankful for, no matter how dark the situation may be. As the writer of Hebrews puts it, as it is, we do not yet see everything in subjection to God, but we do see Jesus. If we can say thank you, it's likely we'll see Christ. And if we're seeing Jesus, then chances are, as Dave suggests, we will reap with shouts of joy and come home with a harvest. Faces turned up to God, we find ourselves disarmed, able to see God's love, Christ's grace, in whatever form it appears. Even a cross. Can you see the cross just vaguely outlined in the middle of that photo? Which leads me to a third point that has improved my thankfulness. This afternoon, I'm going to sit down for a Thanksgiving meal with my in-laws and nieces and nephews. We will be without my 55-year-old sister-in-law, my wife's oldest sister, who died of cancer on the first day of school and whom we buried 2 weeks ago. When we were informed in January that Carolyn had 2 to 6 months to live, the news hit us hard, especially the kids. For one niece, the shock and pain was too much, and she medicated with some risky behaviors. With their world reeling, the family called me and my wife for help. Suddenly, Andrea and I found ourselves doing our best to care for our niece in crisis. As we sat with her, a hidden story of brokenness emerged. And all we wanted to do was gather this girl up in our arms and tell her over and over and over about all of the good qualities we see in her and remind her of all the good things she has contributed to other people's lives. If you're like me, you want to immerse her in love to the extent that the lies that threaten to break her apart will have nothing to grab onto and will be washed away, never to be seen or heard from again. Trained professionals who counsel people with addictive behaviors or mental illness will tell you that broken and vulnerable people tend to think that there is nothing good about themselves. Wounded people, as well as the people closest to them, have to be reminded that their flaws or compulsions do not cancel out all the other good characteristics in the person who is sick. At one point during his interview, Dave said, "One of the things that happens when you get into crisis is you suddenly seem to forget about all the good things that God did for you in the past. You get this tunnel vision, and you can't envision anything good happening in the future, and you become hopeless." One of the things I realized, Dave added, was this. Even if the future doesn't turn out well, your present crisis never negates the good that happened in the past. In other words, something doesn't have to be perfect to be good. There might be only one piece of goodness in a very large mess of badness, but that one sliver of goodness is still something to be thankful for. I think the same can be said for the plain and ordinary grind of life. The demands of work and family and church and housekeeping and paying the bills can feel relentless, to the point that all you can see when you roll into bed at night is what didn't get done. What I've learned from Dave and my friends in recovery is to stop qualifying my gratitude. I have a house, period. Thank you, Lord. My kids make me laugh. when we were putting my son Seth to bed following the funeral for Carolyn, he told us he'd had a blast, except that his stomach didn't feel too good. "Why do you think that is?" we asked. "Well," he mused, "I ate like 27 cubes of cheese and about 30 crackers at the reception. That made me feel a bit funny, so I drank 3 cans of Pepsi. But that didn't seem to make a difference. I thought some ice cream might settle things, but the two revels that I had didn't seem to make a difference. It kind of made it worse. And the glass of iced tea I drank didn't help, so I'm not sure." Thanks, Lord, for my 10-year-old boy. Speaking of which, the McDonald's French fries tasted good last night, and they didn't cause too much gas. Thank God. Hands held high toward heaven, we are open to receive, like a cup, all the goodness that God pours into us. We are free to embrace the gifts, big and small, past, present, and future, that Christ offers us. I don't know where you're at on this Thanksgiving Day. I find myself a bit more hopeful, a bit more grateful, despite the fact that the day before us is uncertain. Today, when I sit down to eat some turkey, I'll be attentive to my widowed brother-in-law and his children, especially his oldest daughter. I don't know what they will encounter on the way, but I will thank God for the gift my sister-in-law was and continues to be to her husband and kids, to her sisters, to me and my children. I will thank God that my brother and sister-in-law remain good and loving parents who did and will do all they're able to care for their children. And I will thank God for that beautiful, wonderfully talented adult niece who loves kids, including my own, even though she struggles to love herself and can't seem to fully receive the love of others. I will thank God that my niece is still able to fill my mouth with laughter and my tongue with joy. And now let's be clear. I'm not saying that I'm going to be this super fantastic, thankful saint. God knows I'll probably be complaining about something before I'm driving off back to Abbotsford. But in those moments when I realize what I'm doing, I won't beat myself up for having failed once more. I'll thank God that despite being a sin-stained and broken person, Jesus is not ashamed to call me his brother. I qualify as a forgiven son of the living God. Amazing. I'll thank God that my half-hearted and half-effective efforts still qualify me as a servant of the crucified and resurrected Christ. I'll thank God that Jesus takes my best and my worst shots and still manages to touch the lives of others with his healing love. As I go forth, I'll thank God that even my most meager thanks, no matter how qualified, actually do qualify in Jesus' books. Actually, I'm really grateful about that. And I'll thank God that at some point down the road, there will be an end to the tears. At some point, things will be right. At some point, God's children will be brought to glory. Those who sow in tears will reap with songs of joy. Maybe after all these years, I'm becoming more like Mr. Regeer than I first imagined. Happy Thanksgiving.